On this edition of Celebrating Science, Frank Wilczek on the origins of mass and the weakness of gravity. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, nonprofit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and members of the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation. In this presentation, The Origin of Mass and the Feebleness of Gravity, Professor Wilczek explores the fundamental concepts connecting mass and energy. He also discusses how the weakness of gravity contributes to the creation of mass. Professor Wilczek is credited with the invention of axions. In 2004, he shared the Nobel Prize in Physics. He is currently the Hermann Feschbach Professor of Physics at MIT and sits on Perimeter Institute's Scientific Advisory Committee.
Wonderful to be here. I've been associated in one way or another with the Perimeter Institute from close to the beginning, I think. The last time I was here, I wore a hard hat. And it's inspiring to see that this building is so beautiful and that it welcomes the public in the way it does. Let me assure you that I won't be using these equations. But I do hope to present things that are serious, really do represent our best knowledge of the world in a way that you'll understand and appreciate. So without further ado, in the first part of this lecture, I'm going to explain the origin of mass. That may sound quite ambitious, so let me qualify it a bit. I'll only be explaining the origin of most mass. And even that needs a little explanation. I'll be explaining the origin of the mass that we talk about in chemistry and biology, the mass of ordinary matter, the kind of stuff we're made out of, the kind of stuff that we thought the whole world was made out of, the universe was made out of, until about 20 years ago, when astronomers started discovering that when you average over the universe as a whole, that form of mass, that form of matter made from protons, electrons, gluons, and photons, dominates our local neighborhood, when you average over the whole universe, such are the vast empty spaces between stars and between galaxies that things that are very rare here, because they occur out there, dominate the mass when you add it all up. So in fact, we have something called dark matter, which makes 25% of the mass of the universe. We have some ideas about that, which I'll come to towards the end, and something called dark energy, which Rocky will explain tomorrow. Right? Yeah. But I really will explain in a profound way the origin of the mass of ordinary matter, that 5% of the universe that's so important to us and to chemistry and biology, starting from building blocks that are essentially massless. I won't be able to explain it completely, but I'll get within 5%, and you can hold that to me. I'll be explaining 95% of the mass of ordinary matter, starting from no mass, starting from building blocks that have no mass. Okay. What does that mean? Just because the words make grammatical sense doesn't mean they correspond to any coherent concept. And indeed, in Newtonian mechanics, the concept of mass without mass is utterly incoherent. In Newtonian mechanics, mass is a primary quantity. It cannot be explained in terms of anything simpler. This shows up in many ways. When I teach mechanics, I don't start with Newton's three laws. I start with Newton's zeroth law, which is so basic, his zeroth law of motion is so basic that he didn't even state it. He just assumed it in passing. That law that dominates, that is essential to classical mechanics, is the law of conservation of mass, that the mass doesn't change of a body or a collection of bodies if they interact. In fact, Newton called mass quantity of matter, with the clear implication that it was the thing that makes matter, that you count up to define what matter is. The soul of Newtonian mechanics is F equals ma, which relates the dynamical concept of force to the space-time or kinematic or motion concept of acceleration. And those are very different things. There's a proportionality constant between them, though, which is mass. Something that didn't have mass literally wouldn't know how to move in response to forces. So it's a very, in Newtonian mechanics, it's a concept that doesn't make sense. Mass is conserved, so you can't possibly explain it in terms of things that don't have mass. And things that don't have mass wouldn't know how to move. They don't make much sense. That all changed a little over 100 years ago when Einstein discovered his second law, M equals E divided by C squared. Many of you are probably familiar with Einstein's first law, E equals MC squared. But this is a different one. I learned how to manufacture laws like this from my friend and mentor, Sam Treiman. Sam was trained as a radio engineer in World War II in a great hurry, along with a lot of other recruits. Not all of them were sophisticated as Sam, and many of them didn't know even basic algebra. Nevertheless, they had to be trained in a hurry to operate radios so that the war could be successfully prosecuted. And the Army did a very, very good job of that. And their manuals became models of pedagogy. And Sam showed me, as I was starting my teaching career at Princeton, this manual that they used as a model of pedagogy. And the first chapter of it, which he was especially eager to point out to me, was entitled Ohm's Three Laws. Ohm's first law, V equals IR. Ohm's second law, I equals V divided by R. And I'll leave it to you to conjecture what Ohm's third law is. Now, of course, to a sophisticated audience like this, that's a joke. And I'm very pleased to hear the laughter. Reassured, I should say, too. But it's not entirely a joke. There's a serious point to it. The very great theoretical physicist Paul Dirac, when asked what was his method of discovering new laws, said, "I play with equations." The point is that writing the same equation in a mathematically equivalent ways can suggest very different things. And that's definitely true in this case. You know, E equals MC squared, famously, calls to mind the idea that you can get a lot of energy out of a small amount of mass, and calls to mind things like nuclear reactors or atomic bombs. This form of the law, M equals E divided by C squared, suggests something quite different. It suggests the possibility of deriving mass from energy. And in fact, that's what Einstein had in mind from the very beginning. You will not find E equals MC squared in his original paper. This is the form you find in the original paper. So really, I should have called this Einstein's first law, but I thought that would be confusing. And the title of that paper was a question. The question was, does the inertia of a body depend on its energy content? In other words, does the mass of a body depend on the energy of the things that compose it? See, right from the very beginning, Einstein was thinking of the possibility of explaining the origin of mass from something else, from energy. And in modern physics, as opposed to Newtonian mechanics, that's a very good thing to do, a very important thing to do. Because in modern physics, energy is a much more primary quantity than mass. It's energy that's really conserved. It's energy that appears in the laws of thermodynamics and the laws of statistical mechanics. It's energy that appears in Schrodinger's equation, and so on. Energy is something we really find deeply embedded in our primary laws of physics. Whereas mass, well, that's a much more technical concept. Let me tell you what it is exactly. It's the label of irreducible representations of the inhomogeneous Poincaré group. Now, just to emphasize that it's a much more technical concept, whereas energy is something. And so if you can explain mass in terms of energy, as Einstein taught us might be possible, you'll really be making progress. Okay, so I promised something quite precise and quantitative to explain the origin of 95% of the mass of ordinary matter. So I better be precise and quantitative about what I'm doing. So what matters for matter? Well, for ordinary matter, let me remind you of basic high school physics, mass is mostly found inside the atomic nuclei, the small core of atoms that contains all of their positive charge and well over 99% of their mass. So within my 95% accuracy, I can forget about the electrons and just concentrate on the nuclei. Nuclei, one used to learn, are made from protons and neutrons. And one should learn, I don't know if pedagogy has caught up with this, but one should learn that protons and neutrons are complicated objects that are made of objects that obey much simpler equations and have simpler properties, quarks and gluons. So we go one level deeper. And saying that they obey simple equations and have simpler properties, and if you think about it, is just another way of saying we have a marvelous theory for quarks and gluons. It's a theory called quantum chromodynamics, or QCD. It's a grand generalization of electrodynamics. In electrodynamics at its heart is the theory of how photons or electromagnetic fields respond to electric charges. QCD is similar in its mathematical structure, but contains instead of one kind of charge, namely electric charge, three kinds of charges that we call colors. They have nothing to do with the color of anything, though. They're just forms of charge. And it's a richer theory in that it has not one photon, but eight gluons that are capable not only of responding to these color charges, but also of changing one into the other. But it's a theory of a direct mathematical generalization of electrodynamics, very beautiful if you can follow the mathematics, very unique. Theorists go gaga over this kind of theory. It's very tight, it's very hard to change without making it inconsistent, which means you get very precise predictions, no fudge factors are allowed. We'll see that in operation shortly. But the best thing at all about it is that it's true. Now, what does that mean? And how do we know? Quarks and gluons are famous for being elusive objects. No one has ever seen a gluon or a quark in isolation. That's their most famous property. They don't exist. They wink out when you try to isolate them. However, that's not really true anymore. And in fact, properly interpreted, what I'm showing you here, right before your eyes, is a picture of a quark, an antiquark, and a gluon. That's them. I'm not sure which is which, actually. It's just quantum mechanics. Like, there's only probabilities. But this is, in some order, a quark, an anti-quark, a gluon. To do justice to this, let me start with something a little simpler to introduce it. So what's shown here in orange are experimental apparatus. These are magnets that guide electrons and positrons and detectors that detect what comes out. The electrons and positrons are accelerated to very, very high energy, moving very, very, very close to the speed of light, within a part in 10,000 of the speed of light. Then they collide and annihilate, roughly speaking, into pure energy. But more precisely, what we mean by that is that they often annihilate into, in the theory, a quark and an anti-quark. So an electron and an anti-electron become, theoretically, a quark and an anti-quark. But what you actually observe is not single particles coming out, but these collimated beams of nearby particles. These are things we call jets. What allows us to propose that these are really a quark and an anti-quark, and to interpret the experiments consistently that way and usefully, is this property called asymptotic freedom, for which the 2004 Nobel Prize was awarded. What asymptotic freedom means in this context is that radiation of rapidly moving quarks or gluons that significantly changes the overall flow pattern of energy and momentum is very rare, whereas radiation that doesn't change the flow pattern but does produce new particles, new quarks, anti-quarks, and gluons, is common. What that means is that if you produce a quark and an anti-quark rapidly moving, they'll produce a lot of other quarks and anti-quarks and gluons moving in the same direction, which can then organize themselves into things like protons and mesons that make up this jet. But only very rarely will they make a radiation that significantly changes the flow. In that case, either the quark or the anti-quark has spit off a gluon, then the same story kicks in, and you see three jets. Well, this machine, this LEP machine, operated throughout the 1990s at CERN near Geneva. It cost a couple of billion euros to build and produced something like many hundreds of millions of collisions like that. And so you could study many, many results of such collisions and see then, verify or not, whether the predicted basic interactions between quarks and gluons that are responsible for these radiation events agree with the theory in all detail, whether the probabilities for them coming out at different angles with different ways of sharing the energy. So the three jets occur about 10% of the time. 10% of the 10%, you get four jets. 10% of the 10% of the 10% of the, you get, or maybe one more, you get five jets. And since you did 100 million, you can keep going till you go to six jets and test the theory in great detail to see whether this gift from heaven that you can interpret the events in terms of elementary quarks and gluons really is consistent with the theory of elementary quarks and gluons given by quantum chromodynamics, given by these ideally symmetric and simple mathematical equations. And it works. I wouldn't be here telling you about it if it didn't work. And through those experiments and many other experiments of a similar nature, but significantly different and harder to interpret, more subtle to interpret, I should say, so theoretical physicists stay in business here, the experimentalists don't make us completely superfluous, you can check whether that property that went into the interpretation of asymptotic freedom, that the ability of the probability of radiation that changes the flow significantly, that's this momentum transfer Q, whether that probability goes down as the strength of the disturbance goes up, and indeed it does in exactly the predicted way. For future use, let me also remark that in quantum mechanics, there's a duality or inverse relationship between the energy of a quantum, be it a photon or a gluon or a quark, and the wavelength of the wave that you use to describe it. So roughly speaking, and adequate for purposes of this lecture, we can say that studying what happens at higher energy is equivalent to studying what happens at very short distances, and conversely, studying what happens at very long distances, when you're studying spread out the reaction of matter to spread out waves of quanta, corresponds to studying things at low energy. How does it happen that the strength of color charges seen at long distances, seen by things that average over long distances, spread out waves, looks so different from the strength of the coupling seen at short distances or high energies? And that, perhaps, is the most to me, is the most profound lesson we learn from this part of physics for the future and about the nature of the world, the deep structure of reality, and certainly for the future of this lecture. Because what we learn is that what appears to us as empty space is in reality a wildly dynamical medium. So when you study a charge out there, you're not seeing it pure. You're seeing it, as it were, through a glass darkly, through the distorting medium of the fluctuating fields, the gluons and the quarks that are popping into existence and popping out of existence all the time, the so-called virtual particles. I wrote a poem about virtual particles, which I'll come to in a moment. But first, let me show you what they look like. So you're now about to see the deep structure of reality, not an artist's impression, but, well, what actually is done when you compute the behavior of quark and gluon fields using very powerful computers to see what these fluctuations look like. So here it is, the deep structure of reality. What's going on inside you and me all the time? What our eyes would see if they had been evolved to resolve distances of order 10 to the minus 13th centimeters and times of order 10 to the minus 24th seconds. They weren't, because that's not very helpful in avoiding saber-toothed tigers or finding desirable mates. But using our noodles, we can figure out what it would look like. I should say one more thing. You're going to see that what it looks like is a lot. It doesn't look, empty space is not nothing, far from it. How can that be? It sure looks empty. Where does the energy come from for these fluctuations? The point is that in quantum theory, seeing is a very active process. In order to resolve those kinds of times and those kinds of distances, you have to use probes that themselves have a lot of energy. And so those probes can supply the energy that make it possible to see the structure at those distances. It's paradoxical, but that's really the way it is. But anyway, we compute, literally compute, using the equations of quantum chromodynamics, the same theory that was so successful in predicting the different jets of different kinds and their probabilities. So this is real. This is the deep structure of reality. Here it comes. Your eyes are about to see 10 to the minus 24th seconds, 10 to the minus 13th centimeters, and there it is, a lava lamp. The universal lava lamp that's inside you and me, everywhere in space, all the time, fluctuating. If we look inside, either by computing or by using high-energy probes to see what's going on, this is what we see. For experts, what's literally shown here is a smoothed-out version, so short wavelength fluctuations are taken out, of the topological charge density in gluon fields in QCD. And of course, in reality, it's not periodic. This calculation was enormously intensive of computer resources, and you only see 5 frames here cycled over and over again, but it gives you an impression of what's going on. With that in mind, we can look anew at the question of building up ordinary matter from these elusive quarks and gluons. Quarks and gluons can't be found by themselves. They always find ways to organize themselves into particles like protons that contain 3 quarks and lots of gluons, or mesons that contain a quark and an antiquark and lots of gluons. But according to the theory, those have to be the building blocks from which the observed particles are built up. And when you look at what experiments tell you about the nature of these building blocks, you find that it poses a big challenge. It poses this problem of the origin of mass, not as an optional problem, but as an absolutely essential problem for the theory to describe the world at all. Because you find that the quarks are almost massless. They have mass, the relevant quarks for the proton have masses which are less than 1% of the mass of the proton itself. And the gluons are strictly massless. So it's not just a desirable thing, it's a necessity to build up, if the theory is to be correct, to build up the mass of ordinary matter from essentially massless building blocks. That's a challenge. What do you actually do? Well, what's actually done is to go to a computer, or banks of computers in reality, that push the frontiers of computer technology. So we're talking about multi-teraflop computers. A teraflop is 10 to the 12th floating point multiplications per second. So big numbers get multiplied 10 to the 12th times every second for months. A month is about a few times, several months is 10 million seconds, 10 to the 7 seconds. The computers have about 10 to the 30th protons and neutrons. And what they do is chug along and chug along, trying to solve the equations for quarks and gluons to figure out how to reach an equilibrium, some kind of stable equilibrium, which would be a kind of disturbance that you could see as a particle, recognize as something like a proton. Okay? So the particles we see have to correspond to the stable vibration patterns, the stable equilibria between quarks and gluons floating around in this fluctuating medium. So here it is. This is what a proton looks like in our deepest understanding. Actually, this is not a proton, this is a pion. A proton would look very similar, but more ragged because it's technically more difficult. But if I weren't honest, I could have told you this was a proton, and I think very few people would have objected. So what's done here is you put in a quark and an antiquark, let them settle down to reach an equilibrium. That's something we would observe as an equilibrium as a particle that has its identity, some coherent identity, and moves along. You average over all those fluctuations. Of course, those are going on all the time and are much bigger than the average values that represent the disturbance in these fluctuations, that those disturbances are what we call the particles, stable disturbance patterns. And this is the disturbance that settles down. Here you can take a time slice, and that represents what's called the wave function of the pion. And similarly for a proton, this is how, in the computer, one constructs those entities, or finds those entities. The theory constructs them for you. They're stable vibration patterns of this dynamical medium we call empty space in response to different kinds of simple disturbances. That's what we are. That's what mass comes from. So We've put these 10 to the 30th protons and neutrons to work for 10 to the 7th seconds, doing 10 to the 12th multiplications, big numbers per second. And the challenge is, do they succeed in doing what every one proton does every 10 to the minus 24th seconds? That is, figure out a stable equilibrium between quarks and gluons that make it have its mass. It also indicates that our methods of calculation are not nature's. There's a lot of room for improvement, as you can gather from the disparity in those numbers. These are the particles that have to be explained on the basis of QCD, starting with essentially massless quarks and gluons, or very light ones. The details don't matter, but they have names like pi meson, k meson, rho, k star, phi, and so forth. These are heavy quark systems and their energy above the ground state. And they are measured with decent accuracy, shown by these squares. Some of them are much more accurately measured. Okay. Now, I told you I had a very precise, beautiful theory. There's an objective correlate to that. That is that if it's so beautiful, any change you make is going to make it worse. If it's mathematically symmetric, any change that you make will make it not symmetric. And in fact, QCD has the property that changes not only make it less beautiful, but even inconsistent with basic principles of quantum mechanics and relativity. So you can't do it. So to fix all the parameters of the theory sufficient to theoretically to calculate all these masses requires fixing three quantities: the mass of the light quark, to which the pi meson is most sensitive, so we fix that by adjusting the light quark masses until this comes out right; the strange quark, which is here; and the overall coupling strength, which is here. Then everything is fixed. You can't change anything else. So everything else has to be successfully computed by the theory, correctly computed by the theory, or it's wrong. That's a powerful theory. No fudge factors, no room for maneuver. And there's the answer after 10 to the 30th protons and neutrons working so hard for so long. This, to me, is one of the greatest achievements in the whole history of science, not only because it was difficult, but because one of these entries here, N stands for nucleon. Nucleon means proton or neutron. This is the calculation of the proton and neutron mass, and thus of almost all the mass of ordinary matter, well over 99% from first principles. So this is the answer. This is the origin of the mass of ordinary matter, right before, indisputably. So now let's see what went into it, to see if we really explained the origin of mass. So massless gluons were one component of the theory. Massless up and down quarks were another component of the theory to make protons, and nothing else. So you'll have to agree that that explains the origin of mass starting from no mass. Unfortunately, there's an asterisk here. So this is a little joke, and I'm glad some of you picked up on it. This is called QCD light. It's just an idealization. Let me correct it, being an honest guy. Massless gluons, that's actually not a lie. That's true. The massless gluons, they have to be massless for similar reasons to why photons are massless or why gravitons are massless. It's required by the mathematical consistency of the theory. Massless up and down quark, that's an approximation. That's a slight idealization. But as I said in passing before, these guys weigh only about 1% as much as the protons themselves. I only promised you a 95% explanation, so I'm still safe here. Nothing else, well, that's also an idealization. The world contains much more than gluons and up and down quarks. It contains photons, gravitons, oh my God, quantum gravity. It contains Higgs particles that we don't know very much about, W mesons, and so on and so on and so on. So all of those can affect these masses at some level, these calculations. But fortunately, we can estimate what difference they make, because they would affect all the particles, and if you put them in the wrong way, they'll foul up not just one thing, but a lot of things, and so we can rule out those perturbations, and we can just assess what difference it makes if you put in those things or take them out. It turns out that they make almost no difference, with one exception. The one thing that makes a significant difference is none of those fancy things of quantum gravity or Higgs particles or anything. The thing that really makes a difference is this strange quark, and including it or not in the calculation affects the mass of the proton at the level of 5%. And so that's why I'm only explaining 95% of the mass of ordinary matter, but that's it. Otherwise, that 95% is completely accounted for in QCD light from entirely massless building blocks. So that's the origin of mass. That's the answer. I've told you. Showed you the calculations. Not the the results. And their logic. That explanation, however, probably doesn't give you a warm, fuzzy feeling of understanding. And it shouldn't, because, you know, I told you, well, you put the thing on a computer, out comes the answer. You examine what you put in, no mass. The mass came out. You've explained the origin of mass. But that doesn't satisfy us. It's an insult to human capacity to just put it on a computer and not understand it. It's also scientifically unsatisfactory because we don't want to have to go to these elaborate calculations every time we look at a slightly different situation and do a new calculation. We'd be satisfied with a more rough and ready understanding that we can use in a wide variety of problems, even if the approximation is cruder. So we want understanding. In fact, that same physicist, Paul Dirac, that I mentioned before, who actually was famous for not saying very much, and it's true, I met Dirac, and he didn't say much. But what he did say, the things he did say were almost always memorable and profound. And another thing he said that's relevant in this context is that Dirac said, "I feel I understand an equation when I can anticipate the properties of its solution without actually solving it." That's very profound. That's the kind of understanding we want. So remember, if you plunk down one of these color charges of a quark, you find that the influence of that charge, the effect of that charge, the fields associated with that charge grow with the distance. Okay, so if you plunk down a charge like a quark, a color charge, it creates a disturbance in empty space, which is self-reinforcing. It's a real catastrophe. It's like a lightning bolt or something that gets worse. You know, it sets off a chain reaction. The fields grow and grow with distance. That's, by the way, is why we don't see quarks in isolation, because they create this disturbance that if you let it go, would cost an infinite amount of energy. It's a disturbance that grows and grows compared to what there would be without the quark. It has higher energy. Okay. So, despite the current U.S. administration, you do have to worry about asking for an infinite amount of energy. Nature won't give you that. And so that's why we can't produce individual quarks. But what do we do? Okay, if those are the building blocks, how can we accommodate them? Well, we have to cancel off this terrible growth in some way. Now, you could cancel it off exactly if you put on top of your quark an anti-quark with exactly the opposite color charge. And then they would just cancel, and this runaway would never start. So that would cancel off the field energy very efficiently, in fact, completely. And that would be the end of the story, except for quantum mechanics. But quantum mechanics means that there's a price to be paid for localizing particles with a very precise position. One way of thinking about it, perhaps the simplest to understand, is that Heisenberg's uncertainty principle tells you that if you try to localize or make precise the position of a particle within some distance delta x, then that particle has to have at least the possibility of momentum, Planck's constant, divided by delta x, which as delta x gets small, the momenta and therefore the energy get very, very big. Okay, so if you try to do this cancellation exactly, there's a price to be paid in quantum mechanics. Okay? You can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't cancel that field energy without getting enormous quantum mechanical localization energy. So there's a competition between two competing effects. So we have to find stable patterns of equilibrium. Those are the stable patterns of equilibrium I showed you before in these computer calculations where they're not easy to find. It takes elaborate calculations to find them exactly, but qualitatively what's going on is you're trying to find compromises between the demands of quantum mechanics that particles are waves and can't be precisely localized and the fact that you really want to cancel off the field energy of quarks, color charges that are widely separated. So you want to keep them close, but not the waves too peaked. You can't do both, you have to compromise. Einstein, when he heard of Bohr's theory of the hydrogen atom, which solved a similar problem, namely why the positive charge of an electron and the a proton and the negative charge of an electron in a hydrogen atom don't just fall into each other, canceling off the electric field energy exactly. Same problem, really. That was solved or postulated away by Bohr in his atomic theory, where he said only certain orbits were allowed in atoms. Einstein, when he heard about that, called it the highest form of musicality in the sphere of thought, because it was sort of a music of the spheres. But Einstein was wrong. It's not the highest form of musicality. The equations of modern quantum mechanics are much more musical. They much more resemble the equations for vibration patterns of actual musical instruments. And in QCD, we have three charges, so we're actually doing chords. Anyway, but it's the same thing. You're trying to find stable oscillation patterns, but now of the void that I showed you, when it's disturbed, as opposed to stable oscillation patterns, say, of a violin sounding board, when you disturb it. But very similar equations, same kind of problem. And because the compromises can't cancel off both kinds of energy simultaneously, they are compromises, there are necessarily energies involved that are not zero, then we use Einstein's second law, m equals e divided by c squared. That's the origin of mass. The building blocks didn't have to have any mass. It's this field energy and quantum mechanical energy competing with each other that can't be taken to zero. There are stable compromises. Those are the different particles. And the energies in the compromises are their masses. Well, I hope you'll agree that that's a poetic description. In fact, I promised you a poem about virtual particles, so let me see if I can remember it now. Okay, virtual particles. Beware of thinking nothing's there. Remove all you can, despite your care. Behind remains an endless seething of mindless clones beyond conceiving. They come in a wink and dance about. Whatever they touch is moved by doubt. What am I doing here? What should I weigh? These thoughts can lead to rapid decay. Fear. No. This is a sonnet. It has 14 lines. It's 14. Fear not, the terminology is misleading. Decay is virtual particle breeding. And the seething, though mindless, serves noble ends. The clone stuff exchanged is a bond between friends. To be or not, the choice seems clear enough. But Hamlet vacillated. And so does this stuff. So, poem reprinted in Fantastic Realities, by the way. Okay. But the real poetry of physics is equations. And I won't be using anything as complicated as those, but let me finish this part of the lecture with some real poetry. Einstein's second law, we've already discussed. And then we have the Einstein-Planck relationship between energy and frequency. The energy of a quantum mechanical particle or wave is associated with the frequency of its oscillation, nu, according to the Planck-Einstein relation, E equals h nu. So we can put those together and find that for a particle of mass m, its wave function in quantum mechanics vibrates at the frequency nu, given by nu equals m times c squared divided by h. These, in fact, this is the way we measure the masses. Okay, in those calculations of the vibration patterns, okay, there's no scale inside the computer. There are no magnetic fields that deflect particles and let us measure their mass. Nothing like that. What we do is study those vibration patterns, study those wave functions, see how fast they oscillate, and from that, read off the masses according to this formula. So it's quite useful. For experts, I should admit that its frequency is an imaginary time, but never mind. So there's a unique relationship between the frequency of these vibration patterns of this universal medium and the masses of the particles, the stable disturbances that we call particles. That's it. And so the ancient idea of a music of the spheres, which was supposed to be associated with the periodic motion of planets around the sun, or maybe the Earth, which never became very precise, although it was very inspiring, and so gets quotes around it, has become in modern physics something that is very precise, I think even more profound and beautiful, a music of the void, and that's what I told you about. Okay. Now, as a corollary, briefly, I'm going to explain to you another classic question of physics, why gravity is feeble. First of all, you may be surprised to hear that gravity is feeble. If you had a hard time getting out of bed this morning, or climbing a flight of stairs or anything like that, or if you're an astrophysicist and are accustomed to dealing with gravity as the primary force on the large-scale structure of the universe, but it really is feeble if we track it down to basics. That is, if we compare what we think are the primary laws, the laws that govern the interactions between elementary particles, we get the forces between planets by adding up all the forces between the elementary particles that make them. If we compare, say, the force between a proton and an electron due to electricity versus the force due to gravity, we find they're both 1 over r squared forces, so you can compare at any distance. You find that the gravitational force is ridiculously smaller, embarrassingly smaller. It's a factor of 10 to the 40th smaller, one with 40 zeros. So gravity really is feeble. Going back to my calculation of masses, I told you I neglected gravitational effects, quantum gravity. We can estimate what effect they would have, and they affect the mass on the level of a part in 10 to the 18th or so. Ridiculously small corrections also. Nevertheless, we think that's a superficial way of looking at the problem. Because gravity in modern physics is associated with the curvature of space and time and how space and time respond by curving to the presence of matter. So it's a very, very fundamental aspect of reality. And we're tempted to try to think that that's one of the most fundamental aspects of reality that we should start with. And we should also start with the speed of light that implements special relativity and Planck's constant that implements quantum mechanics. Each of these quantities is a sort of honorary number in the sense that they play primary roles in profound theories of physics that we'd like to build up the rest of physics out of, that wouldn't make sense without the existence of these kinds of these quantities. So, for instance, in the special theory of relativity, the essence of the special theory of relativity is that time and space are things that can be transformed into each other. What I see as a spatial interval, someone moving along at a constant velocity in a moving frame will see as a mixture of a space interval and a time interval. But space and time are measured in different units. One is measured in centimeters or inches, the other in seconds. So for that notion to make any sense, that you can transform space into time, you need something that does the conversion, and that's what the speed of light does. Similarly, to convert energy density into curvature, so that in general relativity you have a direct proportionality between energy density and curvature, they're measured in different units, you need Newton's constant. And in quantum mechanics, you have a direct relationship between energy and frequency, as I showed you. There has to be a conversion factor, that's Planck's constant. So these are things we can't do without if we believe in general relativity, special relativity, and quantum mechanics. But if we're willing to take those, we don't need anything else. Pythagoras had this vision that all things are number. Well, that's wrong. It's not true that an inch is a number. It has different units. It's not true that the size of an atom is a number. It's a size. It has its length. However, So in that form, Pythagoras' vision is not correct. However, if you take it that we're going to need these three quantities because they appear as essential elements in the profoundest theories of physics, then that's all you need. Because from these, by taking appropriate combinations, you can find a length, you can find a unit of time, you can find a unit of mass. Those are called the Planck's units. And in fact, Planck, when he discovered his quantum of action, was excited not because he thought it would explain the stability of matter or lead to a fundamental explanation of chemistry or technology or any of the things that we know it eventually led to. He didn't know that. What excited him was that fact that now he had enough to make a complete system of units. Okay, but if that's the complete system of units, gravity just is what it is. Its strength is connected to the size of that g. So it doesn't make sense to ask, why is gravity as feeble as it is? It is what it is. It couldn't be anything else. G is part of, it's an honorary number. The real question, but nevertheless, there is a phenomenon that gravity does appear to us as weaker than the other forces. Let's do an experiment. I just overcame the force of the entire Earth trying to pull me down by gravity using a tiny piece of the chemical energy that I imbibed with breakfast this morning. I skipped lunch. And I can keep doing it. Right? I can do it for a long time. I don't want to subject you to it. But there is a real sense in which gravity is feeble. It appears feeble to us. Why does it appear feeble to us? Well, gravity is proportional to mass. Our mass mainly comes from protons and neutrons, as I explained. And so the real question is, why gravity is feeble is because we're made out of protons and neutrons that are much lighter than they should be, naturally. So the real question is, why is the proton so light? That's what makes gravity appear so much feebler than the other interactions. Going back to here, in this plot of how the coupling strength changes with the energy or distance, the Planck scale of distance or of energy would be way out here. In fact, it would be outside the known universe. I'm sorry. This is a logarithmic scale. It would be out here somewhere. Sorry. However, we can't measure all the way out there, but we can extrapolate what we know to see and make hypotheses about what the physics is out there and run it backwards to see if it explains things about our world, and in particular, why the proton is so light. So, according to the philosophy of Planck units, the basic physics goes on over there. Okay. There's some coupling strength for the basic color charges, but they get distorted by this distorting medium of quantum fields that are fluctuating, and that makes the coupling constant, as you go to longer distances, gradually grow. Okay. And eventually that leads to the catastrophe, which makes us compromise with quantum mechanics, and that's where the energy comes from to make protons. Okay. But the point is, before the fields really build up substantially to make it worthwhile to compromise over here, it takes a long, long time, a long, long run in energy or distance. And so from the point over here, you have to limp, not only walk, but sort of it limps along like a wounded snail here. Only here does it start to really run, does the catastrophe really start to set in. Only here does it really become worthwhile to compromise, to take a hit in quantum mechanical energy and make protons. So this is what determines, where that happens determines what the mass of the proton is. And that's why protons are so light. It's because it took a long, long time from a moderately weak coupling over here at the basic scale for the fluctuations in empty space to build up into a catastrophe and make it worthwhile to make protons. That's why the proton is so light. And numerically, what you find, if you work this out, is that instead of the discrepancy of 40 orders of magnitude between the basic strength of gravity and the electromagnetic or the strong force measured at the distances we see, if you extrapolate it out here, the discrepancy is nothing. So that's progress. But is it right? When I showed you this plot, the experiments stop here. The LHC, and will, at a cost of several billion euros, will go to here. And then it gets really difficult. So to see if it's right, we have to call on the full resources of physics. I'll only indicate this very schematically. This is known physics. This is the standard model. Almost all of known physics is displayed here. And you'll have to agree that given that it explains almost all of known physics, it's a pretty compact description. And experimentalists have been trying very, very hard for the last 30 years to find flaws in this standard model without success. So it really is close to nature's last word. It contains this theory of QCD that explains the origin of mass as one part. That's the SU3. It contains electromagnetism as one part. That's the U1. And it contains a theory of the weak interactions. That's SU2, which I didn't discuss. So tremendously successful. It describes an enormous range of phenomena in terms of very, very little and tight mathematical concepts. This is close to nature's last word. But because of that, we should judge it by the highest standards. This is getting close to the core of our understanding of nature herself. And viewed by the highest aesthetic standards, this leaves a lot to be desired, because we have three different interactions of a similar nature. They're sort of begging you to be regarded as different aspects of one more fundamental interaction. We have five different kinds of matter related by the symmetries of the different interactions. We'd like to have them all unified so that they look like different sides of a single die. But this is what we actually observe. Using our noodles, and even worse, well, let me not belabor it. By an active imagination, we can see if those pieces can be fitted together into something more unified. And it didn't have to happen. It doesn't have to work. If these charges were different, or if these if this rectangle were 2 by 3 instead of 3 by 2, it wouldn't work. Okay. Conversely, nature seems to be telling us that because it is possible to derive the standard model from a more unified theory, we're tempted to think that that is the underlying reality. And here I've displayed one of these unifications, perhaps the most beautiful. It's based on having the particles and their charges be symmetrical in a 10-dimensional space. It's called SO10 theory. In that theory, all the different kinds of color charges and the strong and the weak interactions are related to each other uniquely. All the different components of matter are related to each other uniquely. If I didn't know the properties of these things just from their charge assignments, I would be able to derive them. And also, those funny charges, instead of being separate from the other interactions, are now integrated. I can't do justice to this, but you should realize that it's a great improvement over that. But there's a problem with it that's very basic to the program of unification and can be understood without reference to the details. That is, the program of unification is to say that the electric, weak, and strong forces are all aspects of one same underlying force. And we have similar theories for them, resembling, kind of, I have a family resemblance with colors instead of charges. And even this possibility of fantastic unification, if we make the bold step of putting them all on the same die, so to speak. But there's a very basic problem. If they really are supposed to be the same, why do they have different powers? Why do they have different strengths? Why is the strong interaction really stronger than the electric interaction? Why does it make atomic nuclei much smaller than atoms? It's because the strong interaction pulls things together better than the electric interaction. However, remember, way back when, too long ago, I told you that the most profound lesson that we learn, I think, from our understanding of quarks and gluons and the standard model is that what appears to us ordinarily as empty space is far from empty. It's this structured, dynamical medium. And in fact, the particles we see are kind of epiphenomena on top of those fluctuations. So we have to correct for the fact that we don't see the particles pure. We see them through this distorting medium. And so if the hypothesis is, as it should be, that simplicity is at the short distances, we have to strip away the effects of this distorting medium in our minds to penetrate to the highest energies or shortest distances. Okay. Now, on this graph, this is again a logarithmic scale. All the measurements are shown at the size of this circle. The next great accelerator will go a little bit further. Then it gets really hard. So we have to do calculations to see what we might expect at higher energies or shorter distances. But we can do it. Okay. Now to make the plot look simple, I plotted inverse coupling strength. So the strong interaction is the smallest inverse coupling strength. That's just so I can get straight lines here. It's really the same plot of changes in couplings that I showed with experiments that I showed before. So this is what happens if you strip away the effects of the distorting medium using just the virtual particles we know about and their fluctuations to lay bare what's happening at short distances. And you see the strong interaction gets weaker. The inverse gets bigger. That's asymptotic freedom, in fact, extrapolated to high energies. Okay, we can do the same thing for the other interactions. So for the weak interaction, we do the same thing. And you see that they do, the possibility of a unification at short distances is before your eyes. However, there's another interaction. Oops. Doesn't quite work. Although they seem to want to be trying to unify, they don't quite make it. Okay, so if we were good Popperians, that if we believed that the goal of physics was to falsify theories, we could declare victory at this point. We falsified the idea of unification. But of course we're not. That's a grossly oversimplified view of how we do things. We try to truthify our theories. And in this case, some of us found a very good way to truthify the theory, I think, promising. In this unification I've been talking about, we've been unifying the different kinds of color charges on the one hand, and we found that that automatically also unified the different kinds of quarks and leptons, the different kinds of matter, if you like, on the other. But it didn't unify the gluons and photons with the electrons and quarks. It didn't unify that way. There is a way to do that. It's another idea called supersymmetry. Supersymmetry involves trying to unify in the other direction, unifying the electron with the photon, if you like, and the gluons with the quarks, unifying particles of different spin. Okay? To implement that in equations, we have to introduce more stuff. To make the equations have this extended symmetry, we have to change the equations, and the equations then have more kinds of disturbances. They support more kinds of disturbances. In other words, more kinds of particles. And so the calculation of the corrections is different. Now the distorting medium is different. It has more stuff. When we calculate the corrections, adding that stuff, everything clicks into place. And you see the unification really does work if you do it in the most straightforward, minimal way. And as a bonus, if I put gravity on this same graph, it would start out ridiculously weak. That's what I told you. In fact, that really would be outside the known universe. It would be on this scale. We have 20, 40, 60. Gravity is at 10 to the 18th. No, 36, 10 to the 36. Way outside the known universe, stretching the boundaries of the multiverse. However, gravity responds directly to energy, not just because of these subtle quantum mechanical fluctuations that change the nature of the charge. And so, if we use higher and higher energy probes, we find that gravity looks stronger and stronger to such probes. Or if we look at shorter and shorter distances, we find gravity gets more and more quantum mechanical at short distances. And so, from way outside the known universe, the inverse coupling comes roaring in, changes much faster. And when you calculate it out, it more or less unifies with these other guys, too. Didn't have to be that way. But we take it as evidence for the truthification of our theory. Maybe we're on the right track. We seem to be getting out more than we put in. Fortunately, these ideas have testable consequences. That's what takes it to another level. To make that unification calculation work with supersymmetry, the new particles can't be too heavy. If they're too heavy, they don't fluctuate enough, and you don't get this nice correction that brought the calculation into line. In fact, they can't be so heavy that they'll escape observation at the next great accelerator, this LHC that I've mentioned several times now. Among the particles that you find when you implement supersymmetry are ones that interact very weakly with matter. They're electrically neutral. And when you calculate how much they would be produced in the Big Bang, they're stable. You'd find that they are produced roughly enough to make the dark matter. So they may even be the dark matter. It's a very exciting time to be a physicist because we're confronting these grand extrapolations and grand ideas about unification in two completely different directions with reality. Well, here's where it's going to happen. If you fly over Lake Geneva, you will notice this red ring on the ground. No, this is underground, of course. This is the Large Hadron Collider, LHC. It's 23 kilometers around. You can see, there's Lake Geneva, you can see the scale of the thing. You don't actually see much on the ground or from the air, but if you go into the tunnel, it's a fantastic thing. This, to me, is our civilization's answer to the pyramids, but much better because it's meant to satisfy curiosity and it's a product of voluntary cooperation and investment in knowledge rather than vanity and autocracy and so forth. Anyway, if you don't go inside the tunnels, this is what you see. This is one of the detectors, one of the main detectors that's going to allow us to sort out the result of the collisions at very high energy. So those kinds of jets, we'll want to sort them out, see how likely different kinds of jet patterns are. If there are deviations from QCD, that's really interesting. That might be the supersymmetric particles showing up and so forth. This detector, shown to scale, is called CMS. C stands for compact. This is the compact muon solenoid. The other detector is called ATLAS, and it's much bigger. That's what it takes. And not only is it gigantic in size, as is the ring, but it's gigantic in meaning, because every little cubic centimeter, in fact, every cubic millimeter, every cubic micron of this thing is packed with electronics or finely machined components that everything has to be just right. A lot of, you know, it's thought as well as size that goes into this. And these are the experimentalists, the heroes and heroines, secular saints. You can see their halos here. That are going to do the experiments, do the measurements, have done the hard work to see whether these bold extrapolations of our ideas to ultra-short distances and whether our ideas about the ultimate unification of the laws of physics are on track and whether we really are understanding the feebleness of gravity at the same level that we've explained the origin of mass, or whether it's all just a cruel joke on the part of Mother Nature. Within 2, 3, certainly 5 years, we'll know whether these are just beautiful dreams or reality. Thank you very much.
This edition of Celebrating Science has been made possible by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, through the support of private and public funding partners, including the Government of Canada and the Government of Ontario. To learn more about the Institute and to enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.